Welcome to the CRE Podcast, 100% Canadian, 100% commercial real estate. Now, here are your hosts, Aaron Cameron and Adam Pawatic.
Welcome to the Commercial Real Estate Podcast, powered by First National. I am Adam Pawatic, sitting here with Aaron Cameron at the Land and Development Conference. It's definitely one of my favorites. I mean, we at First National finance a lot of construction. It's definitely intellectually one of the more interesting areas of real estate, so it's always a good conference. We've got an action-packed agenda today. This is our first podcast of the morning. We're here with Brad Keast of Dream. He's the head of development and construction. He's got specialties in the office space. He's got a panel later today on that very topic. So we're going to spend a little time talking about office, but we are going to make an assumption here for everybody that...
Did you hear? Yeah, there was this pandemic. Yeah. People working from home for a while. Office use is down. What else?
We might be coming back. We might not. You know, that debate happens a lot.
I think the only constant is nobody knows what's going to happen.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay.
If you weren't aware, I would suggest going back and listening to the 35 podcasts we've recorded in the last 8 months on office.
Yes. We're going to assume an understanding of where office sits right now because, Brad's an expert. We want to capitalize on that and not spend 20 minutes setting the stage for where the market is. But Brad, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So before we jump into the office discussion, tell us about yourself, you know, how you got into real estate, how you ended up where you are.
It's not the most straightforward path. I'm from Orillia, graduated. I went to RMC. So I did a degree in computer engineering. And then after that, because it was RMC, I spent 5 years in the fleet. So spent a total 9 years in the Canadian Navy. Was posted in Halifax, Victoria, and then Ottawa eventually. When I was in Victoria, I started doing a program in urban land economics, specializing in property development, so postgrad diploma from UBC. And while I was doing that, it seemed interesting at first, but the more I did it, the more interesting it became. And I can remember there was nights where I would go with some friends, I'd walk home, and I'd stop by construction sites and I would look at them, try and figure out what's going on. I would get home and more than once, I ended up Googling until about 7 or 8 in the morning until I had to go to work the next day. And then I can remember sitting in the wardroom, which is sort of the officer's mess on board ship, and other guys, they're coming in and they're showing these magazines that they bought about weapon systems and all sorts of Navy things across the world. And I realized, you know what? Probably isn't what my actual calling is. And so did that program. My last posting, as I mentioned, was in Ottawa, finished the UBC program. And then when I released from the military, I teamed up with a friend who's at the time, he was a planner at the city of Ottawa. We tied up some land. We tried to do a small 3-unit condo and then quickly found that no one would back us, didn't get any equity financing. And now in hindsight, we realized we didn't even know what we didn't know. So lost a bit, paid some tuition to the School of Hard Knocks, but it was a good learning experience. And then from there, I actually stretched that and a few other things I was working on onto a resume. And I got a job off of Workopolis at Smart Centers. And so I moved to Toronto for that job in late 2006. Spent a good stint at Smart Centers working on unenclosed shopping centers all across Southwest Ontario. And then from there, found myself at Osmington. I was there for about 6.5 years, worked on Union Station, as well as a number of their other developments. And then I've been at Dream a little over 5 years now.
One of the things I enjoy about real estate is for a lot of people, it's not a direct path, but that one's straight a little further than most. You know, a lot of times, that's why I started as a lawyer and found out I hated it. Now I'm in real estate, you know, that's more of a meandering path to get there.
Well, shout out to the Sauder School of Business. I think you've got the diploma from there too, don't you?
I've got credits from it. I've done some of the course. I've not completed it.
I'm the same, but I think I'm 10 of 12 or something like that. I got close enough. I was like,
and then kids got in the
way. Exactly.
I was going to say, one of the things that when I first joined the industry, the thing that I found most interesting was that you could get people from all different backgrounds coming in at all different levels. And I think that really leads to like a stronger team. And coming from the military side, where the only way you become a general is to be a colonel. And the only way to be a colonel is to be a lieutenant colonel. The only way to be a lieutenant colonel is a major all the way down. So
can't fake it.
But it's also not set up so that, so for instance, why can't a very senior executive at Amazon come in and be the head of logistics for the entire military in uniform? Just It's not possible.
Well, I think real estate's like that too. It's a community, and we all grow up with each other, right? So to speak. It's just and smart centers is a great place to start and to learn the business. You're not the first person. I was just remembering Selena Raji. Was she there at the same time as you?
She's been on here. Yeah, we sat next to each other.
There you go. Right. She was on here, and she's she learned the same experience as you did through smart centers. So let's just fast forward then. When did you end up at Dream, and what are you doing today?
So I had a number of conversations with Dream. Someone who I actually used to work with at Smart Centers was there and started bringing me over. Had a few conversations, and then I can remember at one point just sitting in a boardroom, and Michael Cooper said, okay, I just want you to bring everything you have to bear on our portfolio. Come hang out with us for 6 months, and then we'll figure out your job description. I thought that seems pretty vague.
Pretty casual.
So we refined it a little bit more and then came in on the office side and then really kicked off with what we call Bay Street Village. So we have a portfolio of 9 properties right along Bay Street. It's these heritage buildings generally built between 1920s and 1950s, and gorgeous buildings, smaller Bay Street addresses, but they needed some work. They needed a lot of investment. And we found that there was a strong market for tenants that took a smaller footprint that wanted the Bay Street address. So you have a couple options. You could either go into one of the large AAA towers, which great buildings, but if you take one quarter, one floor, you're lost in it. You don't have a whole lot of presence, or say you feel like small fish in a big pond. If you come into our buildings, which we've now revitalized, we've really restored the charm and character of these heritage assets. So it's a different approach, and you can also have a full floor for your 5,000 square feet. And so that gives an entirely different experience for anyone coming in. And we did all that from an aesthetic standpoint. We went and we looked at what a few companies are doing in London and Japan and elsewhere, and the idea of a boutique luxury office building. And so if you look at the hotel space, there's a lot of boutique luxury hotels. We thought, why not do that in the office space as well? And so brought in a designer by the name of Paolo Ferrari, a lot of history, a lot of experience globally in the hospitality space, came over. And so he did all the washrooms and the lobbies. So there was
the common space.
Yeah, exactly. And now they're at this extremely elevated experience. And also the thinking, the time, most people are going to spend more waking hours at work than they are at home. So things like facilities you use should be just as nice.
This is pre-pandemic?
Yeah, we started pre-pandemic and finished the last part of the project, finished up earlier this year.
And how's it going?
It looks fantastic. It looks really good. Tenants and brokers have all been, the reviews have been fantastic. As we all know, vacancy is up a little bit, but the work that we've done has been really key in helping us differentiate our product versus the rest of the market.
Well, I mean, now obviously you're in much more of a fight for tenants than you would have been pre-pandemic. I mean, pre-pandemic, you're enjoying obviously the tailwinds of the lowest office vacancy rate in North America. So for assets that, you know, you've not completed a recent major works plan on, what are you doing to them to try and get tenants in? Like, what's the strategy for buildings you're looking at that you're about to start that process in the current environment?
So for a lot of those, we're fortunate that we have, in some cases, we have buildings with pretty long WALTs. And so we have some time before anything gets into a tricky situation.
Weighted average life, though, just
across the portfolio.
Weighted average life.
Oh, sorry. And so that's across the portfolio. Some of them where we have one tenant that takes up most or all of a building, in those cases, we know when they're going to expire and we can start planning for that now, and we're doing that. It'll be really doing a lot of lessons that we've had from recent full building retrofits that we've done. So we've done completely retrofitted 357 Bay that WeWork is now in. They take up the entire building. Right across the road, we're getting close to finishing one at 366 Bay, and we have tenants going in. There's actually, in about half an hour, there's a tour for a potential tenant to look at the whole building. And so there is a lot of tour activity, which is good. And we find that the approach that we've taken, where you're cleaning up the floor, you're really improving all the systems, because when the building's vacant, you can strip out all the M&E and really modernize and get it ready for the next 80 years, effectively. And so tenants are really liking that. Tenants are getting more sophisticated. So things on the ESG side are really important, which I know we'll talk about. We secured a bunch of funding from CIB last year, Canada Infrastructure Bank, to help us decarbonize 19 of our assets, which gets us closer to our stated goal of being net zero by 2035. So those things are all, they all play together. And then another piece that we've had good success with in the last couple of years is we've been building up our in-house construction capability. And so we can actually, on behalf of the tenants, because again, a lot of our floor plates are smaller, so we have smaller tenants, for them to take on a design and construction of an office space is just not in their wheelhouse. It's not one of the banks where they have a whole real estate department. And so we can take that on for the tenants. And we've had really good feedback on that. And between what we've completed and what's almost completed, we're at about 165,000 square feet that we've built out for office tenants.
And learning along the way.
Absolutely. Learning along the way, building better relationships with not only the trades, but also the manufacturers. So the equipment manufacturers. So we're, because one of the things that we've seen through COVID is lead times are just, they've gotten extremely long. Some pieces of major electrical equipment, it could be 60 weeks now. And so having those relationships is really important so that we can, one, and we're changing how we're procuring in terms of making sure that we're getting some packages out early so that we can get that started while other parts of the design are still going, so that we're not
sitting there waiting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, great feature too is the tenant's sitting there burning through like a free rent period waiting for this to happen. And all of a sudden they're into paying rent and the work's still ongoing. It'd be problematic for some tenants, right? So you're taking risk off the table for them, or reducing the risk anyway.
Right. Yeah. If it was them waiting for the equipment versus us doing it. Yeah, correct.
Let's go theory first, and then let's go into some of the ESG conversations. I think that is an interesting angle. Will we ever be back at work 5 days a week?
I think that depends on the company. I've been back at work 5 days a week for about 2 years.
Okay, on average.
You're in office. Everybody in office has been back 5 days for a long time, you know? Yeah.
It's like John Love and King said, they never left, right? Like and I think the same thing with Michael Embry and Allied, right? Like those guys.
Flying the flag.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you got to walk the talk, so to speak. But I mean, my thing, I'll answer, you don't have to answer it, but I think it's 4 days, maybe max. Like you had to just be on aggregate. Across society, Canadian office use is 3.5 days, 4 days, probably no more. And where I'm going with that is, therefore, you need the office space because you probably want everyone in at the same time, at least once or twice a week, but then you have this downtime. Is there any change to the way the users are looking at the space, needing the space? Like what alterations? Because before it was, if you have 100 staff, you need 100 cubicles for 100 people 5 days a week. Now you need 100 cubicles for 100 people 2 days a week.
Right.
And then now you've got a whole bunch of empty space or unused space for the other 3 days a week. How does that play itself out?
There's a big distinction between what we do as a landlord and what the tenants do as tenants.
Yeah.
Obviously how they use their space. Let's start with, in general, what we're seeing with tenants as they're starting to roll or their leases are coming up. It's all over the map. So some tenants are not very many, but some would just absolutely stop having office space and they, I guess, will go fully remote. Some are downsizing. Some are using the opportunity, especially with the increased vacancy. They may be able to consolidate much easier than they could before. So they know the floor above or below them is vacant. So why not use that opportunity to take three offices and make it one? And we have some that are growing. There's still tenants that are absolutely, their businesses are booming, and they're growing, which is great.
Which industries?
It could be all industries, but it's very—
an individual basis?
Exactly, okay. Yeah. So the one I'm thinking off the top of my head is in sort of, it's a health tech.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, but yeah, absolutely. There's some that aren't growing.
Mixed results.
Exactly. Again, it's just all over the map. From there, when you think of how many times per week people will be in the office, I think even within a company, you'll have a wide range. So for instance, people that are building operators, they have to be. It's really hard to operate remote. There's groups I, even if we're all in the office, I never interact with. And so if they're at home, then there's not a whole lot of collaboration that we do. I think within their teams they do. And so I think you'll see team by team within offices that do that. Really by function. So for instance, accounting, IT, et cetera.
Is there not competition amongst landlords to attract the tenants? I mean, particularly in an environment where we're at vacancies, what, 15, 20%, depending on how you read it, maybe going up, maybe not. I mean, let's just leave that. But if the vacancy level is healthy, if anything, it's not as frothy as it was pre-pandemic. We've had a couple conversations with Office Hutchison. What was the name of his company? Do you remember from out of Calgary?
Aspen.
Yeah. Aspen Properties. And, you know, he was just talking about experiential office. I mean, maybe he's extreme, but you know, they're putting basketball courts in their lobbies, right. And you know, their whole second floor is a gym that's free to any tenant, and you know, all these things to attract the tenancy. So they're basically taking on the aspect of, I'll create the fun and the environment, you just build the cubicles. Are you seeing that pivot, or is that those conversations occurring in your
trampoline park?
Yeah, I mean, it was all sorts of stuff, right? Yeah.
So we've looked at a wide range. We haven't had a whole lot of, I don't know of any tenant that has said, can I have a basketball court, or I really need a foosball table or anything like that. I think bike rooms for sure is a pretty obvious one. Some fitness. And even then, does it have to be in the building, or does it have to be a tenant exclusive amenity, or does it just need to be in the area? So I think one of the biggest things that from an amenity standpoint that we offer is that all of our buildings are really well located. And so you have everything that you need nearby, be it great spot for coffee, lunch, after work drinks, any services, dry cleaning, haircut, et cetera. And so just by being well located, we inherently have a lot of amenities that we didn't have to build, which is great. For our assets on Bay Street, for instance, though, we're looking at them as a cluster. And so the ground plane, the retail level is really important. So we're really making sure that we're attracting great tenants that are in there. And then the idea that that brings a real excitement and buzz to the area. And then that'll entice more people to be excited to have their office there. And that's been playing out. So between that, the aesthetic upgrades that we've done, the work on the ESG side, the decarbonization, these are all things that they really like. And we haven't had any real pushback. Yeah,
attractive tenants breed attractive tenants, I guess. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It seems intuitive, doesn't it?
Well, on the topic, obviously, the end users of the space, the employees, they pay attention to, you know, the goat yoga at lunch or whatever. my mind's trying to wander to the most extreme examples I think of. But ESG, the corporate side of the people signing these leases, they care about ESG in a very significant way, especially with the kind of office space that you're offering in the areas you're offering it. You know, how much of your work has been done on the environmental side in the last handful of years, which I imagine is, a few business cases for why. And then I'm going to drop a term that was new to Aaron and I that Brad told us prior to recording, which is social procurement strategy. Aaron and I love getting new terminology. So I want to find out.
You guys are the first ones to be doing this.
That I know of, maybe. Well, within real estate, there's definitely, if you look at mining, automotive, they've been doing things like this for a long time. And even in the States, there's a lot of...
Was this a Michael Cooper idea? We had him on a couple of months ago. I mean, he's a big thinker.
He's a big thinker. I think it started organically, really. There was a bunch of initiatives that were being done internally. And then eventually the idea came out that while we try and deliberately seek vendors that are effectively diverse vendors. And so you step back and think really long term, the idea is how do we improve our supply chain? And so how do we attract more vendors to the space? And how do we build connections with more vendors and more suppliers so that we have better resiliency within our supply chain, better options? And if you have 10 options, you're probably going to get better pricing. So, and at the same time, if we can support the communities within which we operate simply by how we direct the dollars that we're going to spend anyways, it all makes sense. It's a win-win-win. So we announced our strategy the end of 2021. And so we have four key KPIs that we're looking at. Two of them are on the spend side and two of them are on the people that are working in the project. So on the spend side, and everything is benchmarked for 2025. So by 2025, we want 20% of all of our contracts to go to local, independent, or socially responsible businesses. And that one, because it's real estate, almost everything you do is pretty local. So that one, we shouldn't have any problems achieving that one.
Yeah, a few incentives to keep you local. Yeah,
right, exactly. The second one is we want 20% of all the contracts going to diverse vendors. And diverse vendors are defined as majority owned or majority managed, so C-suite, by people from equity seeking groups. And there's an entire definition that a lot of different governments have for that. And it's basically any group that has been historically not provided the opportunities to succeed. The other two KPIs are on the teams working on it. So we want 20% of all the project hours are worked by people from equity seeking groups, and then 30% of all the trainee and apprentice hours, people from equity seeking groups. So announced that in 2021 last year, and we're still doing it, is really benchmarking. And we announced it and we were pretty humble about it. We said, here's where we want to go. We're not sure how realistic this is or exactly how we're going to achieve it. And so we had some ideas. So we announced it, and the idea is every year we'll be putting out a report that talks about our progress, and we'll talk about what's working really well and where we're seeing challenges, and just be very open and share those lessons. So the first thing that we've been doing is really benchmarking across our existing vendors. And so they've all been sent a survey that they have to self-declare. And then from there, we'll be able to understand sort of where we're starting from, of what percentage of our spend is going to diverse vendors. And then the next step, which is what we're starting to really get into now, we have a couple new development pilot projects that we're working through with this strategy is when the bidder lists are put together, making sure, do we have one diverse vendor in each trade, at least in each division? So that's a great starting point, because then if we say, look, there are no, for instance, diverse vendors that are plumbers, then we can go back to, there's a number of industry bodies that advocate on behalf of various diverse vendors. And so we can go back to them and say, we're having trouble finding a vendor that meets this profile and can also work on a project of this scale. And so that's where we're
just raising awareness.
Exactly.
One more question on this, because we're unfortunately almost out of time, but we joke that you guys are the first, but what was the reception like? How is the industry taken, and other people that you believe are now kind of following suit?
For investors or
That's a really good question.
It's been very well received. So in fact, the Toronto Community Benefits Network gave us an award 2022, recognizing our initiative. And they've been very receptive. They want to help introduce us to a number of groups. There's a number of other bodies around. So for instance, there's a group called CAMSI, Canadian Aboriginal Minority Supplier Council. So we're members of that. They have a lot of training that's available. And so they're very open and receptive, and they're excited to see a company like Dream partaking. There's CCAB, the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business. There's ACA, the Afro-Canadian Construction Association. So these are all extremely active industry bodies that we're able to work with and have a good response from. And then also with government RFPs, it's been very well received. So I think it definitely helped us win a couple of RFPs in the last couple of years.
We have to wrap up, but we've had Searing Yankee on, who was also talking about many sort of initiatives by Dream on similar, like
Dream Impact Fund
and just the affordability focus on many of the developers that she's working on. Of course, we've had Michael Cooper on, a podcast to be released very shortly, where he's just talking about all of these things that he wakes up in the middle of the night thinking about, right? As a big thinker. And it really does highlight that you guys are really at the forefront of a lot of this stuff that is coming. Like, no matter who you are, what you're doing, and part of the commercial real estate community, this is all part of our responsibility, and it's happening regardless, right? And I think it's kudos to you guys at Dream for being at the very front end and being leaders in this part of our business. So thanks for just being socially conscious, I think is the best way to put it.
Appreciate that. And the team that we have working with us it's amazing. And everyone's just very open and loves to exchange ideas and really help each other to achieve everything that we've committed to. And it's exciting. When I look at all the projects that are happening around Toronto, I think we have all of them.
Yeah. Well said. Everyone else is boring. Yeah. I'm teasing. I said that. You didn't say that. Yeah. Thanks very much for coming on. Really appreciate you having us. Thanks to First National for powering the podcast. See everyone next time.
Thank you for listening to the CRE podcast. The information from this broadcast is not to be relied upon as financial, investing, professional accounting, or legal advice. First National Financial LP holds Financial Services Commission of Ontario license number 10514 and 11252.